A mix-up means hundreds of Duval County school kids are being transferred to new schools yet again. Councilman Bill Gulliford calls for private investor funding to fight the city's opioid crisis, and it's getting pretty quiet and lonely these days. Over at Unity Plaza, some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, a busy news week to discuss, and we're going to spend most of the hour talking about it with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, take a journey back in time to the disco era. That's right. We've got to look ahead to this weekend's big Studio 54 Jax bash at the Florida Theater. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly roundtable as we welcome Andrew Pantazzi, reporter for the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
New to the roundtable, John Bachman, anchor at Action News Jax. Hey, John.
Good morning.
Also new to this show, Angela Spears, radio host and former anchor at First Coast News.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being here. And rounding out our foursome, Tim Gibbons, editor at the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good morning.
So great to have you guys here. What a great foursome we have today. And there's so much to talk about, from education news all around the town to a big push to make big business pay for opiate addiction treatment here in the city. All of that ahead. But our top story this morning: due to a so-called human error, hundreds of kids in the Duval County Public Schools are being transferred to new schools yet again. Did you hear about this? Now, it all started 2 years ago when Duval violated the law when it enrolled hundreds of students from four failing schools into other schools, including some schools rated D or F. State officials now say they want the district to take corrective action about all this and reassign nearly 400 students out of their current schools to a third school for next year, and that school has to be rated C or better. Now, this means parents of the affected students are going to get letters this week or next week enrolling their children in a new school, regardless of how well those students are doing where they are right now. Understandably, a lot of parents are upset about this. They will have meetings and be given the option to opt out of the transfer or pick another school. By the way, magnet schools are not affected by this, but it's a hugely disruptive move for hundreds of students. And we're going to begin the hour with a closer look. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And as always, we welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Andrew Pantazzi at the Florida Times Union, let's begin with you. School board member Ashley Smith-Juarez says this is just more disruption, more confusion, more uprooting for students that have been shuttled around several times. And this is not going over well, I think it's fair to say, with the parents that have to deal with this.
Yeah, no, it seems like this is a big failure in the effort to increase an element of school choice in the school district, allowing people to move around. It seems that it was done very poorly. When these schools were transferred to specialty schools, they were supposed to be going to schools that were either as good or better, C grade or better, and instead some of them were going to worse schools. I don't understand exactly how Dr. Vitti was able to interpret it in this way, but it is definitely a shame for those students who did not go to improved schools. Though it does sound like the superintendent, the interim superintendent, is saying that families will have an opportunity to decide if they would like to transfer or stay in the schools they're currently in.
That's right. John Bachman, anchor at Action News Jax. Former Superintendent Nicolai Vitti apparently misinterpreted the situation when these decisions were made. It's being chalked up to human error, but that's, you know, that's cold comfort to the families that are going to be affected by this.
Yeah, you hear the frustration in their voice when you talk to them, and as any parent would understand that feeling. And now you wonder what's next, how did this happen, and you want the best for your children. So something has to be done, and the question will be, how do you rectify it?
Exactly. And Angela Spears, let's talk about the reasons why for this. According to the state numbers, 39% of the affected students are still not proficient in reading, 35% not proficient in math, a year after their old schools closed and they were transferred to the schools they're in now. This isn't a new story for Duval County. As educators and the school board try to bring up test scores, improve struggling schools. But it seems like in some respects they can't get out of their own way in trying to meaningfully address some of this stuff.
To address the issues that are going on with our students. And I think, you know, parents I've been talking with, what they're saying is just make it right. Do what's right, do the right thing, right? We always want our children to do the right thing. And, you know, are we looking at, is the school district looking at the strain, as John mentioned, the strain that this could cause on parents and what this is doing? And for those kids, as Andrew mentioned, those children who wanted to go to those other schools or maybe they want to be in the school that they're in now, you know, do what's right. And how are we going to fix it? How are we going to make it
right? Tim Gibbons.
Yeah, I think the issuance of the waivers is the only thing that makes us like even a, partially acceptable thing. Maybe the idea that you've jerked these kids around multiple years, if they want to stay somewhere, you have to let them stay. But this is the sort of thing, in some ways approaching education from a business standpoint, this is the type of thing that has led to the rise of charter schools, because you have this monolithic school board doing things affecting hundreds of kids, and you know, parents feel like they end up that the kids are just a number on a spreadsheet somewhere, not that they're actually looking at individual kids.
And in this case, even more bureaucratic, because this is coming from the state, where it becomes even harder to manage, which is one of the challenges that even school districts are having, is when there are new rules, new laws being passed saying how you can transfer. Again, there's been this increased effort beyond charter schools, even to add an element of choice within the school district. I think this is one of the things that in Dr. Vitti's time he really heralded was the School Choice Expo, the ability to look at what individual schools specialized in. But as the state changes rules and adds new rules, the district is dealing with how to interpret those rules, how to implement those rules. And then the parents are even below that trying to figure out what does this mean for their kids. It makes it feel very difficult to understand what's happening in the school district and what's happening to your children.
Well, to piggyback off of both of those, it really does boil down to size too, right? You're talking about tens of thousands of students trying to be managed, and how you do that. You're trying to shuffle people so that you can meet the guidelines for class size and all of the other things that you've got to meet, the mandates that you have to meet.
549-2937 to join our Friday Media Roundtable. So given this rosy situation, how would you feel about becoming the next new Duval County School Superintendent?
I love your transitions.
The school board's going to pick one next week. They've been operating with an interim superintendent, Patricia Willis, as you guys just mentioned, since Nicolae Vitti left town last year to lead the Detroit schools. Okay, so let's review. The new superintendent's going to have to be dealing with funding problems, very unpopular transfers. In a moment, we're going to talk about a violent incident at Rebald High School. Yeah. They're having to deal with all of these school security mandates from the state. Why would anyone, I just have to ask this, why would anybody want this job?
It's a tough job.
Yeah.
It's going to be a very, very tough job coming into that. And it's not a position I'd want. Melissa, maybe you'd want it.
No, I don't think so.
I think it's a good feather to put in your cap to say you took on a struggling school district, a school district that is a minority majority, a school district that has had trouble with bedroom community surrounding it, where people are going for the schools in those counties. To be able to say you took that on and you turned it around is pretty important. I think that's why we see some of the finalists are being attracted from places like Hillsborough County, Nashville, Houston.
Good candidates.
We're seeing people from large school districts. And I think that that's a big reason. We see that some of the big stars in the school superintendent world are people who went into struggling places, had success there. Whether the success was actually related to them or other economic factors is somewhat irrelevant. They get to put this on their resume, and now they're those are the type of people who get considered when, you know, in New York City or in L.A. is looking for a new superintendent because they took a place sometimes the size of Jacksonville, sometimes smaller, and they turned it around.
And you know, Melissa, you had mentioned why would someone take this position as well. You know, in the past, we know under the past administration with a school board that sometimes voices weren't heard, right? The community was not heard all the time. And I've been talking with people and they're saying, you know what? We want someone who's going to listen to us, who's going to listen to the needs of our kids, listen to the needs of the parents and what we want to see happen in the direction that we want our school system to go in. So mm-hmm. hopefully this new person will take that into account.
I'm really curious how those interviews are going to go. The, you know, having them open to the public, having them live streamed is a really good stuff in terms of transparency that
parents, people will be able to watch the interviews on live stream.
Right. And that that's so different from, I don't know, you haven't covered a range of boards and you end up with those ones that try to very much keep it secret. Obviously, I think transparency, I mean, as a journalist, I think transparency is a good thing, but particularly for a school superintendent, having parents feel that they are part of that process, like Angela said, is a very helpful thing.
It'll be interesting to see how different the school board handles it this time around. If we think of last time when Dr. Vitti was selected, he was selected to be the transformative, I'm going to come in and impose a lot of new policies. And immediately a lot of teachers felt that they were being pushed into a corner.
They didn't like that at all.
No, they didn't feel like they were listened to. They felt like he was coming in with his Harvard ideas. He was coming in from Miami and instituting ideas that worked elsewhere rather than first coming in and listening. So it'll be interesting to see if they still emphasize the transformative, you know, I'm going to turn everything around, or if they'll look for someone who has more of an idea of I want to go slow.
Well, this is actually, I think, a Jacksonville problem that I think of as a problem. Maybe it's not, but oftentimes we'll get something, a situation where we say we want someone who's transformative and they come in and they do transformative things.
Like, I can't count the number of times I've seen that. We need a change agent. We really need someone who's going to shake things
way.
Up.
Don't change anything.
But actually
just
don't really
outcome.
Change anything.
Right. Yeah. Or a change agent who does exactly what we, the school board, or we, the district,
the
want you to do.
The powers that be.
And these people take these jobs and they come in with full of energy, good faith, naivete, and they start changing everything and then there's this hue and cry. Wait, we didn't really mean that. We really wanted you to change everything.
We just
everything.
Want different outcomes. We want to do keep on doing the same thing, but you
but
should change the outcomes.
That's exactly right. We want to have more A schools, but we don't want you to change anything to get those A schools. Right.
And I love the fact that the candidates are more diverse this go around, that you have a lot of diversity when it comes to that. And Andrew, I think that addresses your issue that you were talking about, or not really the issue, but the minority-majority concern is that you have that, and maybe it's someone who can come in and will take all these things into consideration, who will be that change agent to say, hey, let's do it this way because this is what our teachers want, this is what the parents want, this is what the community wants, and this is how we need to do it. So hopefully that can be a factor and help us when it comes to our
couple things. I think change, of course, is tough for anybody. I agree, Jacksonville definitely has that about us, but on the other hand, nobody really likes change. They might think they do, and then when the change comes, it's hard, whether it's in a superintendent or anything in any walk of life. The other thing I'd say is, you know, like any CEO, superintendents are hired for their role. Sometimes it's like a head coach. Sometimes you need a Tom Coughlin and sometimes you need a Gus Bradley. You hire for what you need, or at least what you think you need at the time. And so you may need a change agent. Maybe this time we need somebody who's going to smooth things over a little bit. And then the next time, another change, you know, however it works. But that's a lot of times how things work.
Sure. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with John Bachman, Angela Spears, Tim Gibbons, and Andrew Pantazzi as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. What are your thoughts? In a moment, we're going to talk about that gunfight at Rebald High School. But first, let's go to some calls at 549-2937. Doran is on the west side right now. Hi, Doran. Good morning. You're on the air. Happy Friday.
Good morning. I wanted to further the point that you and the panel were making. I was saying to the producer that I think that in addition to vetting the finalists for this position, the board needs to vet itself because of what you just described. The board has worked against all the change and the improvement, and they've been their own barrier to the success and progress of the district. So they need to check themselves out and say, hey, where are we with change? Where are we with improvement before they really bring in another stellar candidate only to write him out on a rail or her out on a rail? That's my comment.
Okay, Doran. Yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah, I'll piggyback on that. I mean, some things that I'm hearing is just the fact that they're pushing this up so that they can vote on it before three new members are put in place. You're talking about somebody they're going to have to work with, and the board's going to look, 40% different than than it does when they actually make this selection. So that's an interesting point.
Which was one of Dr. Vitti's big struggles is people on the board, including those who came after his selection, who he butted heads with, people on the board who he struggled to have a unified vision on. And so I think that's going to be really difficult if the new people who come onto the board do have a different vision than the people that they're replacing.
And that's been a long running problem and story for just not only with our school board, but school boards all over the country, because what we're seeing happening is these clashes between traditional public school advocates, some of whom are former educators, and candidates that are getting elected to school board positions, often being bankrolled by those who are in favor of increased school choice, school charters, more privatization. And that clash is what we've seen over and over again in recent years on this school board. Tim?
It goes back to, I think, your first question of who wants this job, where, you know, in some ways, it's a really interestingly thankless job. You know, when we talk about a CEO being hired, there are plenty of companies that where the CEO and the board can clash, but, you know, the board is hiring and firing the person, and the company has picked a board that usually, you know, absent activist investors or something, isn't totally fractious. Here you have each individual school board member has their own constituency, and this idea that we're going to have one unified voice that's not how it's set up. So whether or not there are new school board members coming in or even the ones who are there, you could easily have a school superintendent who a good minority of the board doesn't want. You know, a chunk of the board doesn't want this person, the rest does. Okay. They get selected and they come and have to deal with this board that some portion does not actually want them there. And also everyone has their own ideas for stuff. I mean, you know, when you talk about former educators and people bankrolled by different interest group, each person has their own thing. That's not a unified vision.
Has it ever been a unified vision on that?
No, I don't even know if we want it to be. But yeah. That's, again, why I've not gone into the school superintending business.
There's so much education news this week. Let's talk for a minute about this fight at Rebald High School. Did you see the video of this, you guys?
That was awful.
Yes, it was. Okay, so here's what happened. A 43-year-old woman was arrested Wednesday outside Rebald after officers were called to a brawl there, and they confronted her as she had a loaded gun in hand. This is according to the school police. Now, apparently two students met in the gym for what they called a pre-planned fight just after classes started, but then trespassers came onto the campus to join in. This happened in the morning while parents were still dropping off students. And this incident at Rebald also happens just as schools around the state are grappling with a new law mandating increased school security and armed officers or armed personnel in the wake of the deadly mass shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in South Florida several months ago that killed 17 people. This woman was arrested. She had a handgun with a fully loaded magazine with 6 bullets inside. District officials say Rebald has one armed school resource officer and 6 school security personnel. They're going to do a safety review in the wake of this incident. And so give us a call. Let us know your thoughts about how school security should be addressed, not just at Rebald, but all our schools, as we continue talking all of this education, this news this week on the roundtable at 549-2937. Angela Spears, I believe your old employer, First Coast News, had some video of this incident and pretty disturbing to look at.
It was very, very, very disturbing. Melissa was talking with someone recently about this, and I think he described it best. He said, and I wrote this down because I was like, you know what, I can't wait to tell Melissa and share this with her listeners. He said, this is another black eye on the community. It's embarrassing. Bottom line, is just embarrassing that an adult would go there and do this. And so another issue comes up. There's so many issues of what you said and what you've just talked about with the security issue, with us as, you know, with adults, with what we're doing with our kids. And yes, I know she said she went to the principal, nothing happened. But another issue is of how open the campuses are and how easy it is for anyone to get in there. John and I were talking about that this morning, that, you know what, even if it is secured, I could open a side door and let you in. I can find a way to let you in. But for the child to call the aunt to say, hey, now they're coming back, and then she's coming back with a gun, showing a gun to the kids. These are children still. Bottom line, they're still children. Mm-hmm. And it really is embarrassing. And I think it's something that we need to take a step back as a community to say, how do we want our children handling problems this way?
Children weren't handling problems that way. He caught his aunt. I mean, isn't this exactly in some ways what people who say, you know, a good person with a gun is needed to help situations. I mean,
but on a school campus. And here's a but tweet, on a school campus.
Here's a tweet from Jimmy listening to the show. One detail getting missed in the Rebalt story is that it was a good guy without a gun who disarmed the would-be shooter. Lynn Shell is a hero. So apparently someone disarmed her.
She did.
He himself was unarmed.
Her description, the woman with the gun, would seem to describe it as she wasn't going to shoot anybody. She had it out so people could see it, basically to frighten the kids. Mm-hmm. I obviously agree with Angela. The entire thing is horrible. I do find interesting the tracing the thoughts of the people in the situation, though, that clearly this woman felt she went to the principal, nothing was done, and her nephew's about to get beat up, and, well, okay, I'm going to show my firearm and scare these kids off. That's clearly not the way they should be handled on campus or off. But if she felt she had no other recourse, yeah, I mean, the answer is basically the school should have dealt with this situation earlier. If kids are meeting for a pre-planned fight, that shouldn't be happening. So, you know, it's almost more like the situation has to be dealt with before the gun got introduced.
I'd love to get all your thoughts too about how Duval County is trying to reassure parents that the schools are secure by putting armed personnel around the perimeter of campuses. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that both John and Angela basically just, you know, alluded to that idea that this campuses are open. I mean, particularly
yeah, there's always you a look weak at a, spot, yeah.
Right? Unless you literally are making these lockdown, you know, gated, guarded communities.
And do we want our high schools to be fortress, prison-like
always,
places?
You have to remember the you know, angst that came when schools started putting metal detectors in. Our kids are going to feel like they're going to yeah. prison. Well, okay. I mean, at some point, you know, the security and freedom way there.
And,
you know.
And beyond that, this is, again, back to what I was saying about, you know, when you have state mandates and state laws that are dictating things. So when the state is mandating you need to have someone in every single school, Duval as a school district probably would rather focus its resources on several schools rather than saying every single elementary school in the district needs to have someone who is paid, you know, near minimum wage and is armed protecting that school. Instead, would probably rather focus its resources on several areas, but because of state mandate, is going to have to use its budget to fund this new program for these armed guards that are going to be going to all the schools.
If you look at the process, you could easily say this was a well-intended legislation with unintended consequences, as so often is the case. But you look at the emotion and passion that came after the Parkland shooting, it was understandable, but now we're dealing with the cost and the reality of what we have to do because of this mandate, and that's mm-hmm. where you have to wrestle and find a balance.
If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. Apparently, everybody in this town is out at the Players' Championship because for once in the history of this roundtable, we are not being flooded with calls. It's very unusual, but we do have some people waiting on hold to talk about the opioid crisis.
John was going to be out there, Melissa.
Yes, and I hope he gets out there later.
And I do want to say, like, this is an annual thing, but, you know, congratulations to the Rebalt Trojans women's basketball team,
yeah.
the greatest women's basketball team in the state. So,
yeah.
you know, let's
and see, why are we about the good news?
So
yeah.
why aren't we covering more of that type of stuff? You know,
exactly.
that's the type of thing, Andrew, that we should all be reporting on more of.
Yes, kudos to them. And let's keep moving through a busy news week because there's some folks waiting on hold to talk about another headline that caught our eye this week. Did you see that Jacksonville City Councilman Bill Gulliford this week made some moves to help create a special city trust fund to deal with the opioid crisis in Jacksonville? Now, this is a fund Gulliford wants to come from private donations. The city has already signaled it's going to sue Big Pharma over the opiate crisis sweeping this city and the country. Medical Examiner's Office says they can barely keep up with all of the overdose deaths. And, of course, there's a pilot program going on through Gateway and River Region Services to help treat addiction of opiates in the city. So before we go to phone calls on this, Tim Gibbons, will the business community step up, do you think, in this manner and try to fund this?
I think they will. I think there's an appetite amongst community leaders, business community leaders, to have this problem get fixed. It's a obviously not a Jacksonville specific problem, but it is not good here. And there are people who have both the I don't know, financial and moral capital to try to address the issue.
And I think there's going to be a question of, do the business community have the appetite to trust public health officials? So when we look at opioid addiction, for example, I think that a lot of people want everyone to just stop using and be able to go clean one way, while public health officials are pretty overwhelming in their unanimous view that buprenorphine, methadone, suboxone, that using medication-assisted treatment, rather than having a view of the only goal is to get you off of any medication, but rather saying this addiction is something that needs to be treated, that it's most important that you are not dying of an overdose, and so we're going to give you a different drug that can help prevent an overdose and can help deal with the withdrawal and the addiction symptoms.
I think that's why this separate board is actually a hugely important step, is the idea that a politician might not want to take that fight on. It's needle exchange programs.
Bill Guilford and Councilman Garrett Dennis want to create a 7-member board similar to the Public Service Grant Council, and it would recommend projects or service providers that would get this funding. So it at arm's length a little bit.
Right. And that board was set up specifically, it was several years ago. It was basically set up because there was an issue with city council used to give those grants out. And there was city council's or the mayor's office. But there was a belief that it was politically motivated, that if you were in good with the politicians, you would get the money. So instead, let's have this arm's length board that, you know, is more just evaluating what is the best grant and giving that out.
And it's 549-2937 to join the Friday roundtable. Let's go to Chuck at the Beaches. Hey, Chuck, good morning.
Good morning, guys. You guys were talking about the school system, and I'd kind of like to integrate this into the school system. But I'll preface it by saying that let's just use the number 100,000. It's probably greater than 100,000. Sunday's Mother's Day. And there will be 100,000 mothers and 200,000 grandmothers dealing with this because their children are dead. It's not good. What I think we need to do, we're being reactive as opposed to being proactive. And you talked about the kids fighting in the schools. We used to teach home economics. We need, and I was just looking online, and we've got two issues. We've got not only opioid addiction, but we've got suicide. This guy named David, he's an actor, his 16-year-old son just killed himself because of depression. I don't think, Melissa, I would love for you guys to do a study to see what kind of teaching we're doing in the school system to educate our children on social skills and help them understand what they can do to be proactive so that they don't get into the situation where they make bad mistakes and go into the kitchen cabinet and get their parents opioids. And that's one thing I would do if I could wave a magic wand. I would make opioids like guns. They would be required to be locked up. So, you know, I think we need to use our school system to do health programs and monitor kids that have depression, bipolar disease, and help them understand what they need to do so that they don't move and self-medicate themselves and they don't make ridiculous and silly mistakes by just partying down with opioids and getting hooked on opioids. And I would just remind you one other thing about the schools when you're talking about guns. You might remember the Episcopal school on Beach Boulevard where the guy walked in and shot. That's been going on forever. And if I was a human resource where you work, you guys need protection too. It's everywhere. We need protection. But I think, back to my point, we need to help our kids. And the best place to do it, I think, is in the school system.
Thanks, Chuck. And thanks for tying the threads of all these stories together with those comments, though really insightful comments from him.
Well, I think, you know, obviously resources are spread so thin in the public school system that it's difficult. But there are groups and organizations out there who do work with students. I can speak for St. John's County PACT Prevention Coalition is working to do just that, you know, and it, for so long it was alcohol abuse, and now everybody's sort of catching on that this opioid problem. We've got the Project Save Lives in Duval that's doing great things and really being heralded throughout
the state and, mm-hmm. and beyond for what they're doing. So I think it's happening. It's just it's going to have to happen with these charitable organizations who can come in and work with the school districts, because the school districts are dealing with guns and meeting standards that they have to meet with all the testing. So, you know, there are priorities that they have put into place, but there are definitely organizations out there working hand in hand with the school districts.
And there are private donors, Melissa, as we all know, who want to help and who want to do things. And I'm just going to throw a twist in here that I was talking with someone who works closely with distributing medications. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, you know, that all the drugs that we get are regulated by the government, that, that it should be a government issue and it shouldn't come to you and me as private citizens. Just another thought.
Sure. And I mean, Florida is getting $27 million from the feds to deal with this. This pilot program in Jacksonville it's a model that Dr. Ray Palm at River Region and Gateways put together to treat addicts. As you pointed out, John, this has been a crisis for years, but people are coming around to the urgency of this crisis. The medical examiner in Duval County, Dr. Rao, is stepping down. When she appeared on this program about a year ago, she told us that literally at the downtown morgue in Jacksonville, they literally cannot keep up with the bodies that are coming into the morgue every day. Overdose victims, and most of the time it's opiates, street fentanyl and heroin and prescription opioids. This is a huge public health problem.
Firefighters are using Narcan hourly on their shifts. I mean, they're using thousands of doses of this, and it's becoming a huge part of their budget now to have to carry so many doses of this anti-overdose drug that everybody's got to have.
And so we're definitely going to have to find a way, I think, for all of us to come together, because, Melissa, you did mention it is a public health issue. And yes, the private investors are government. You know, we've got to find ways to better use the dollars that are coming in federally at the state level, local, and all of us.
I think it's kind of a mosaic approach of, you know, that there is the, so you have the federal dollars flung into one program, and you have, you know, private donor dollars flung into other programs. In some ways, not throw everything against the wall and see what sticks, but let different people do their, you know, take the federal dollars and funnel them through the fire department and through the city hospitals, and have private donors who do different types of programs, which hopefully will just let us attack the problem from different
directions. And let's go now to Woody in Arlington. Hi, Woody. Thanks for holding. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a couple of remarks about, the methadone program. I have a family member who struggles with the opioid problems and has been through those programs several times, and they just don't work. They're substituting one drug dealer for another drug dealer, and these folks are going in there and they're not getting any help.
What do you think would help, Woody? What do you think would work?
Some type of hospitalization and treatment where the people are off the streets and being drawn down under a more controlled environment.
Okay, thanks for that.
Fix this, because you're just putting these people back out on the street again, and it's a joke. It's just a man around going around.
Right, and I think the pilot program I mentioned a minute ago is trying to change that model, because as you pointed out, Woody, it hasn't worked for a lot of people, but it's a small program and it's only helping a few people to start out with. So thanks for that call.
It's a small program, but it's a huge problem.
Yep.
And the problem isn't being dealt with.
Thanks, Woody. Let's go to Daniel. He's downtown. Hi, Daniel. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. How are you?
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
Hey, one thing that y'all haven't mentioned is the option of medical marijuana. And, we're seeing people get off the opioids all the time. You know, every day we're getting to hear new stories of how they're replacing their opioids with medical marijuana. I mean, just New York came out with a study yesterday. They're down, their opioid use for people on the medical marijuana program is down 32%. Now, I'm sure the feds aren't going to allow any of the money to go to the states for medical cannabis, but I can tell you, if it's your family member and you care about them, you need to go investigate medical marijuana.
Thanks for that. And actually, NPR just reported a week or two ago that two new studies out in April show that medical marijuana appears to have put a dent in the opioid abuse epidemic. The research shows some people are turning to it as a way to treat their pain and willing to substitute it for opioids.
But that's the issue that I think Andrew was kind of alluded to, and Angela as well, of this idea that what do you consider success? Is success somebody who is just, you know, living a clean life and has no, let's call them, foreign substances in their body? Or would you prefer somebody using medical cannabis instead of opioids that are going to kill them? And kind of depending on what you're trying to get to, there are people who would say no, methadone even. You know, there are people who would say no, if you're using medical pot, you haven't solved the problem. Now you're just using a different drug. There are other people who would go, yeah,
but
cool.
It's a drug that won't
it's
kill
you. It's
a drug
you. That won't kill you, so yeah. Fine. Do whatever you want to do. You're not dying.
And let me just point this out. That they studied data from Medicare. So these are seniors that are going
huge,
and getting medical marijuana.
Population of medical pot.
And they found a 14% reduction in opioid prescriptions in states that allow easy access to medical marijuana. Dispensaries like Trulieve here now in Jacksonville and around the state, they found that dispensaries reduced the number of opioid prescriptions by 3.7 million daily doses. States that allow homegrown marijuana saw an even bigger reduction. Now, of course, Florida is not one of those states. But what about that?
Well, I think this also goes to the question beyond medical marijuana, but also the people who are using drugs are not just using them for medical purposes. They're using them for recreational purposes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, again, this goes to the question of even the definition of drug abuse, which drug abuse is distinct from drug use. It's the idea of someone who does not have control of and who feels that drug use is playing a negative part in their life and is controlling their life. As opposed to someone who, say, on a distinction between using Suboxone and using heroin that may be laced with fentanyl, where you don't know the purity of the heroin, is that with Suboxone, you may use it for the rest of your life, but that's not drug abuse if you feel that you have control over it and you feel like you're still able to have a productive life. And then this goes to marijuana, where you can be using marijuana for, you know, recreational purposes, but is that drug abuse if you feel like you're still able to carry on and in your life?
And here in Florida, these dispensaries are few and far between. They're tightly regulated, and that was done by design, Angela, John, so as to cut down on the abuse of these medications. And so...
It's
your
an
thoughts.
Interesting. Well, I've got a lot of them, and I'm not really sure.
I'm not really sure
where I fall on the spectrum, to be totally honest with you. Because here's the thing. I mean, first and foremost, just yesterday on Action News Jax, we ran a story about this very issue about whether, you know, medical marijuana should replace some of these things. And you talk about some studies, but the reality is, because of the current laws, it's hard to really do legitimate studies because you can't get the medical marijuana across state law. I mean, there are issues there with the studies themselves. And so the medical community hasn't quite fully bought on board with any of this yet. And there could be other reasons for that. Big pharma could be a cause. There's lots of things that you have to dive into. So I guess part of my problem is that you go open one door and you get inside and there's four more doors you got to look through. So the other thing is, you know, I have seen poor legislation cause other side problems. You know, when I first got to Jacksonville, as we were looking in the state of Florida to pass medical marijuana, I went out to Los Angeles, you know, to see, okay, they have very loose regulations as to, right, you know, their medical marijuana there. And I got off the airplane, told them I was staying at a hotel, showed them my Florida driver's license, and was able to get medical marijuana with no... I saw a doctor, and for those of you at home, I'm using the air quotes. And the doctor gave me a prescription for medical marijuana, and I was able to get it within an hour or two.
What voters in Florida wanted as well. And I mean, if you look at our current regime, it's not necessarily compliant with what voters thought they were voting for, which was probably more in line with that sort of thing. I think there is a line that if people want medical marijuana, they're not voting for recreational pot. And I get the distinction between that. But we are in a weird spot where it comes to the laws, that there are many people who think that this is a beneficial thing for them, and any growing number of people don't have a problem with that, but we're still stuck in a, you know, just say no to drugs sort of legal place.
It's certainly fascinating to watch it play out in this state, for sure. But I do want to make note of one other story that caught our eye this week, a business story. It's getting pretty quiet these days over at Unity Plaza in Brooklyn, sadly. Brick's Pizza there closed its doors this week after just 22 months in business. It was the last of three restaurants at the plaza that was still even open. Now, it was only 3 years ago that Unity Plaza opened with a grand flourish, promised daily events for residents. It was going to be a gathering place, but ever since it's been plagued with financial problems and people not showing up to party there, $2.6 million in city dollars went into this Unity Plaza project. Tim Gibbons, what went wrong?
Depends on who you talk to, but first, just to make sure we're being clear, there's 220, the residential project, and Unity Plaza, which is the retail and grassy area. They're separate things. Mm-hmm. So 220 apparently is still, as far as we can tell, going along perfectly fine. Unity Plaza was kind of, it never caught on the way that developers thought it would for a myriad of reasons. They didn't have the event stuff. There's also an argument
they
that...
They started programming events at the beginning, but then it fell off.
Yep. No, yeah. The executive director who was in charge of that left after, I think it was 6 months or so. It fell off. People would have events there when it started. It never quite fit in. I think part of the issue was it's trying to be an urban mixed-use development. People would walk to it, and you might live in the apartments and hear more noise than you would otherwise, but people are okay with that because, oh, we're in the city.
And I've also heard the restaurants couldn't make it because the rents...
Rents
like
were
the
high.
Like the best-selling book, the rent was too damn high.
Rents across Brooklyn
are high. I've heard
Brooklyn
that over and yeah. over, that those restaurants could not pay the rent. It was too
high.
Well,
the rent might have been fine if there was enough traffic, too, though. I mean, it's that old argument. Yeah, the rent's too high, but it's too high for what was actually
well, how
there.
How about the fact, can I just say, as a woman who likes to go to events wearing high heels?
Yes.
What about the gravel parking lot
the
next
gravel
door?
Parking lot,
that does not work for
the
me.
The first time I went out there and that the amphitheater, the grassy lot, whatever you call it, Timothy, there, the steps were so steep when you're going up and down. So why would I want to go there?
Yeah, because first you have to survive the gravel lot.
But once
you
survive that,
up the stairs,
up and down that, and it's not for those who have mobility issues. I don't think it's very good. And plus, you have other options, too, where people can go. You know, you have now Daly's Place. You have the Times Union. You still have the arena. But those are just some of the aesthetics of it. And the seating is horrible. It's not comfortable to sit there.
They needed a woman's touch.
And
what
we're sitting on.
You guys have been waiting for this for a long time, haven't you?
Yes, we have.
It's poor urban design all around over there. So you take right next to it, you've got Fresh Market, where they said, you know what downtown really needs is a strip mall. Because the Jacksonville Landing isn't enough of a strip mall. Let's put a strip mall here where we've got a big old parking lot.
Jacksonville Landing wants to grow up and be a strip mall. I mean, Landing dreams of being a strip mall.
But they put a strip mall there.
But finally, we got to stop and talk about the strange, bizarre, and ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida does a man get arrested for throwing a Big Mouth Billy Bass at his boyfriend's head. Do you remember this? The Big Mouth Billy Bass?
Oh, yeah.
54-year-old Gregory Carney from Sebastian was arrested on battery charges after he threw one at his boyfriend after an argument. They were all the rage about 20 years ago. The animatronic fish mounted on the wall that sings such favorites as Don't Worry, Be Happy and Take Me to the River. Yep. Remember that? You can still get a Big Mouth Billy Bass on Amazon if you want one. I even remember when it was a plot point on The Sopranos.
I'm pretty sure it's the classiest wall decor you can have in your house.
That speaks. The classiest speaking wall decor.
It's a Florida story. So thanks to our Florida panel, Andrew Pantazzi, John Bachman, Angela Spears, and Tim Gibbons. Enjoy the players. Enjoy the weekend. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you for having us. Have a great weekend.
We'll be right back.
I want to sing it note for note. Don't worry. Be happy.
Surf Pro of Jacksonville South and Arlington are proud to support the J.T. Townsend Foundation, helping children and adults living with disabilities on the First Coast. Learn more or donate at jttownsendfoundation.org.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. One text or call could hurt your company's bottom line if an employee causes an accident. Learn about Terrell Hogan's distracted driving presentations for the workforce at waynehogan.law.
on the next Fresh Air. James Forman Jr. talks about his book, Locking Up Our Own, which won a Pulitzer Prize last month. The book examines the role played by African-American community and political leaders in creating the era of mass incarceration. He's the son of James Forman, who headed the civil rights group SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Back home, three Americans held prisoner in North Korea. On the back foot, CIA nominee Gina Haspel after a barrage of questions. And out front, Michael Avenatti, who says he's just getting started.
People send us information. People want to help our cause.
The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm Ira Plato. This week on Science Friday, elephants shake the earth as they walk. And as seismology grows more sophisticated, could we use these rumbles to prevent elephant poaching? Plus, if you're always running out of time, no problem. Physicist Carlo Rovelli tells us why time doesn't really exist. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Finally, this hour, go behind the velvet rope this weekend with, or next weekend, with a fabulous journey back to the disco era. Studio 54 Jax is taking over the Florida Theater next Saturday. For one night only, you can celebrate the glamour of those infamous private parties at Studio 54 in New York. Event co-chairs Troy Sperlin and Missy Peters are here, along with someone who actually went to Studio 54, Barbara Colicello. Hey, everybody.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you all. In a moment, I can't wait to hear from Barbara about her memories of this and some photos she's going to tell us about. But first, Troy, Missy, this sounds incredible. Tell us what's going to be happening.
Melissa, I have to tell you, there every so often an event comes up that you just want to get on the rooftops and scream it out to the city of Jacksonville. I think this is going to be one of the most epic parties that we've seen in Jacksonville.
It sure sounds like it. I mean, when you read about the heyday of Studio 54, you can't help but kind of think, gosh, I wish I could have been there. Missy Peters, you're going to try to give that experience to this community.
Absolutely. And I don't want to give away all of the surprises, but we have some amazing tribute performers. Elton John, Donna Summer. And
gotta have Donna Summer.
Yes. And Barry Manilow are going to, we'll have some tribute performers for them. And we're going to end the night with Boogie Freaks as well. Think Roller Girls and Rainbow Shots, too. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
And people are, of course, encouraged to come in 70s disco era attire.
Totally.
Right?
People can come in that. But also, if you thought that, you know what, we're going to fly out this weekend to New York or London and go to the hottest club in town, wear that, too.
Gotcha. And this is all to fundraise for the Florida Theater. Okay. Barbara Colicello, you actually partied at Studio 54.
Yes, because at the time I was working for Andy Warhol, and I started working with him in 1977, and that's when 54 opened.
You saw it all.
I did.
Were you there the night Bianca Jagger came in on a white horse?
Yes.
You were there?
Yes.
That's incredible.
Yes.
That's amazing.
That was Andy's second home, and the kids of the factory, we'd all get to go. We would get to go in. And in fact, we would do private parties there. And one of the evenings, Andy asked me to be at the door. So that his collectors, his art collectors, would be sure to get in. Because sometimes...
yeah, the velvet rope. The Studio 54 pioneered the whole idea of the velvet rope, and only a few people could
get
past
it. Would eyeball people, and if you had a certain look, they'd let you in. And one of the things that people equate with the 70s is polyester. But at 54, if you were wearing polyester, you will not get in.
You dressed to kill.
Yeah, you had to have a sense of style.
You have some photos that are related to this era.
Yes, during that time, Andy, of course, took millions of photographs, and he published a book called Exposures. And so part of the promotion for the book was to create a portfolio of some of the photographs. And I was lucky to have one of those because my brother, who was the executive editor of Interview for 13 years, Bob Colicello, co-wrote the book with Andy. And so he got some of the portfolios and gifted one to me.
Aren't you lucky?
Yeah.
What memories? Was it really as incredible as people said?
It was. Every time you went there, the minute you walked into the door, you were transformed to someplace else. Steve and Ian were both just amazing party givers. They just knew how to do it.
Steve Rubell ran the club, and Mike Myers played him in the movie version. People can watch that, too.
Troy. Yeah, and I was going to say, I speaking to what Barbara just said, I think that's what's so exciting about this event, is that the entire theater is going to be transformed. To many people, it's going to be unrecognizable. We're really trying to recreate the iconic Studio 54.
Well, you're an amazing designer, so I know that it will look incredible.
Thank you.
Okay, Missy Peters, people are going to have the time of their lives. And this is all to benefit Florida Theater.
Absolutely. A lot of people don't know that the Florida Theater is a nonprofit here in Jacksonville. And all of the funds that are raised that night are to help support that, this iconic historic place in Jacksonville. So we're excited about it, but we want people to be entertained as they come. So we want people to boogie on down and get their tickets at the Florida Theater. We only have 30 tickets left. So,
oh my gosh, yes. What a hot ticket. And it is so worth the price. You get endless cocktails, plated dinner or heavy hors d'oeuvres and cocktails up in the mezzanine. There's going to be a concert with guest artists performing the music of Elton John, Donna Summer, Barry Manilow. Live dance music by the Boogie Freaks. The piano bar will feature the Andy Warhol photographic prints that Barbara's bringing.
Yes.
Which is amazing. And Troy Sperling's going to be there.
Hey. You can't miss that.
You can't miss that, right?
Melissa, I'm ready to boogie on the dance floor with you.
I am ready, baby.
Good.
I can't wait.
Bring it.
And this is next Saturday night. Next Saturday night. May 19th, Studio 54 Jax. Get your tickets now at floridatheater.com. And thanks Troy Sperling and Missy Peters, the event co-chairs, and Barbara Colicello, bringing some really legendary memories and photographs to the event. Can't wait to see you guys next Saturday.
See you on the
dance floor, Melissa. What am I going to wear?
That's half the fun.
Absolutely. Is half the fun. All right, get your tickets. Keep listening for 1A and enjoy your weekend, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.